This is an interview with Dr. Charles Kaplan. The date is November 7th, 1982, and the interviewer is Howard Broecker. Dr. Kaplan, I'd like you to begin by telling me about your early life.
I was born in Toronto, Canada, in 1913. I'm the fifth of six children. My parents came to Toronto in 1906. They were married in 1904, and they came here because of during the pogroms in Russia. My father's comment was, "This is no way for a human being to live," and he came to Toronto with one child at that time.
Do you know what his hometown was?
He came from Yaroslav, which is in Bogoliv Gubernia in Russia. And my mother came from a very small town named Krula, which was also in that same province. But they had lived in Petersburg, which is now Leningrad, right prior to the time they came, because they had special permit to have his tailoring shop there.
I see. And what were their names?
My father was Nochem, who was used Nathan as his name, and an English name. And my mother was Golda, and she was Golda Belia in Yiddish. Her name was Schuster before she was married, and my father's name correctly is Kapelson, K-A-P-E-L-S-O-N. His father was Koppel, but the immigration officer didn't know how to spell it, so he became Kaplan.
Uh-huh. And they immigrated directly to Toronto?
Immigrated directly to Toronto, where my mother had an uncle, and the Solomons, who also, I guess, were Schusters, were there, and they spent the rest of their lives there. The emphasis my childhood was a very happy one, and we always had a good time. It was a very loving family and very active in the community, and my mother was very active in the Jewish hospital there and helped build it, and the Ezra's Nushim and the Hadassah and all the other things, so that those are activities that I was part of all my life.
How would you classify them? Middle class?
Up and down middle class.
Yeah.
They did very well at times, and at other times, 1917, 1918, they lost everything, but money wasn't of any great significance. They were always rich even when they didn't have money. They always lived well. But my father's always notion was, as long as you have your health, you can earn money, and he always did. He lost it. He made it back a few years later, and towards the end of his life, he was very comfortable. He was still giving us gifts, and he managed very well.
What was his business in Toronto?
His business was whatever he could afford, whatever he could make a living at. He came over as a tailor and put falsies in the clothes of the English women, and that led him to success, but then he found out that it was much easier to make a living in real estate, and he went into real estate, and during the First World War, real estate went kaput, and he said, well, the one thing everybody needs is food, and he organized what was known as Dominion Canning and Preserving Company. He made jams and jellies. Subsequently went back into the real estate business, was in the fur business for a while, whatever it was that he could make a living at, but essentially he was always in the real estate business, and even at the end, that was where he had his income that was derived from that.
Did they belong to an Orthodox synagogue?
Yes. They belonged to an Orthodox synagogue, but they were very free in allowing us to choose our own beliefs, and that we didn't have to rigidly follow them. My grandfather and grandmother lived with us all the time they were after they came to this country, and my grandfather was very religious, and he was a real Lubavitcher and belonged to the Lubavitcher shul. My grandmother, on the other hand, was a very bright woman who had previously been married to somebody whom she divorced because he was a civil engineer in Russia, and he had to change his religion in order to practice his profession, and as a result, I think she was very anything but religious. My grandfather was very religious.
Are these maternal or paternal?
Maternal.
Okay.
Paternal parents never did migrate. My paternal relatives, there were several of them in Yaroslav, and then they, Two of them went to Moscow and had their families there. Two of them went to Harbin and had their families there. And two of them came to Canada. And that family that was in Harbin are scattered now. We meet them in Israel, South Africa, Australia, and they are all the children of first cousins, because my father was the youngest in the family, and his brothers and sisters were much older.
Did you go to Tamatora?
No, we lived out in in the north end of the town, and we always had a Rebbe come to us. So as long as I could remember, we had the Geller David, who was also the Shochet in the area, and he was my Rebbe. His name was Raskin, and his son now works for the New York Times. But a very, very bright individual whose children have all done very well. My Rebbe I still occasionally run into.
So you had a fairly traditional upbringing.
Yes. We were kosher at home. In fact, I remained kosher, I guess, until I went off to college, and by necessity, or by what I thought was necessity, became less religious.
Tell me more about your parents' philanthropic activities, especially your mother's.
I mentioned my mother was involved in the Jewish hospital, which now is the Mount Sinai Hospital, which is a very big and affluent and prestigious institution in the community. At the time she became involved, there were, I think, about a dozen women who had to collect money for the hospital, and they were very active in it. She was treasurer and vice president, and I don't know whether she's ever president of that organization or not, but in any case, one of the vivid recollections I have as a child is that my mother would be home Friday fixing the Shabbos dinner when she'd get a call, "Golda, they need you at the hospital," which meant that she had to drop everything and run down to the hospital. And when she'd get to the hospital, all these women would get into bed. If they had time to take their shoes off, that would be fine. And that was because the inspector was coming to count the number of individuals who were in hospital beds. And then the city would provide them with whatever the fee was per week. And that was the way the hospital was able to survive economically. And this is a story that she was on the board of trustees of the Mount Sinai Hospital much later. They used to say, "Mrs. Kaplan, tell us the story about how things were in the past." And no matter how difficult things were at that time, they'd say, "Well, they're a whole lot better now than they were then."
And since then, that hospital has become a major hospital.
Oh, yes. It's part of the university system. It afforded, it was a necessity in Toronto. Toronto was a community where there was a great deal of anti-Semitism at certain levels. For instance, there was not any discrimination as far as getting into medical school, but once you get out of medical school, you couldn't get in on the staff of any of the hospitals, and unless there was a Jewish hospital, you wouldn't have any hospital affiliations. That situation does not prevail now, but it prevailed right up until after the Second World War. And so that it was a necessity for the women, and also provided food that was kosher. There were no kosher food at any of the other hospitals. In order for an Orthodox individual to go to a hospital, the food had to be brought in prior to that, and this provided them with a hospital with kosher food.
Any other outstanding activities or outstanding philanthropies that either of them?
Well, they were very strong Zionists, and my father was active in the Zionist organization. My mother was active in Hadassah. She was president of that organization. We always used to kid my mother because she had these cups. When they finished their presidency, they would be given a cup. So we would say this was the one my mother won for running, this was the one she won for swimming, and these were the cups that she acquired as she went through life. And there was the Sons of Jacob, and there was the Sons of Jacob Benevolent Society. And those societies were formed not only for social purposes, but also for providing medical care to that community, and they would have agreements with various doctors who would take care of the group medically, so that it was more than just a social organization.
Well, it sounds like the environment that you grew up in was preparing you to take an active role in a Jewish community wherever you ended up.
Yes, it wasn't just an active role, it was a duty that we recognized was duty of every individual to make his contribution to society other than his own personal needs. And this was something that I think we all felt and we all participated in. But you ask about what my parents' religion is, I might say that my sister is, she's not an agnostic, she's an atheist. My brother belongs to the Reformed congregation. My next sister belonged to the Orthodox congregation. The next one belongs to the Reform. I'm the next one, and Sid belongs to a conservative organization. So that we've all had our interests, although I think we're probably, as far as our religious beliefs, except for my eldest sister, are not too that different, but we've joined organizations that are probably not only religiously compatible, but also socially compatible, wherever community we're in.
Tell me quickly about your own education and career.
One can go about that very quickly because I just graduated from public school, high school in Toronto, and college, and got my bachelor's in the University of Toronto and my medical degree, University of Toronto. In order to get a good internship, one had to come to the United States. So that in 1937, I came to the United States, and for the next few years, I was in served as an intern and then as a resident. I had 2 years in psychiatry and then 3 years in pediatrics. And that took us up to the year 1942, and at that time I was in Pittsburgh, where I met and married Lil, and subsequently went into the U.S. Army, where I was for 4 years as a psychiatrist, because I didn't care about my pediatric training at that point, and left as a major and with a lieutenant colonel final. So I served in the Army, and not unenjoyably.
Had you already made a decision to live in the United States?
Yes.
And that was the reason you joined the U.S. Army?
Yes. I became a citizen very shortly after I was in the joined the Army. And there was no question about where I was going to live. I was going to live in the United States. And the last post I was at was in Florida, and at that time, Bill and I had the choice of going anywhere in the world or anywhere in the United States that we wanted to. Well, yes, we could have gone anywhere. We could have gone to England or Australia or New Zealand or South Africa, because I did have a Canadian, I had a British license, which allowed me to practice in any British area. But then, as I say, we concentrated in the United States, and I rode away to various communities in the United States, like San Diego, not Los Angeles, but San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Detroit, Michigan, and a few others, and asked them for descriptions of their climate, and then the Chamber of Commerce as to what business conditions were, to the county medical society as to what the medical situation was, to these medical schools, if there were any, and a few other points. Then I had a big chart in my office, and I scored each one on a 1 to 5, and Seattle came up with the highest score. We had never been to Seattle before, but since it had the highest score, we just came to Seattle, and it was a very wise and good choice for us.
What was the year that you came?
1947. I would get out of the Army in 46, but since I'd been doing psychiatry for a long time, I went back to school for 6 months at Harvard to get some postgraduate work in pediatrics again. So that
you knew that pediatrics was what you...
Well, there was no question about it. Yes. No, at no point. No, I was even in the Army. My role in the Army was not so much as a practicing psychiatrist, as we were in a very large psychiatric unit, and I was the commanding officer of it, because I was a pretty good manager as compared to what the other psychiatrists were. And whereas they were good psychiatrists, so that we each accepted our role, and and that's the reason I got good promotions right along, because that's the emphasis in the Army. And came here in 1947.
Okay, to backtrack just a little bit, Toronto had never been an option because of the anti-Semitism.
Even then it was an option, but not a very viable option, because the it was prior to the time that the new hospital was built, the new Mount Sinai hospital was built. The old one, which was on Yorkville, was, I don't think it was more than 30 beds. And so that it didn't really provide, and I would not have been able to get an appointment at the medical school at that time. Oh, 7 or 8 or 10 years later, yes, they did open it up to the Jewish doctors, but up until that time they didn't. And I enjoyed teaching, and I had done some teaching during my residencies, and I wanted to continue doing some teaching at the medical school. Whereas Seattle, the medical school was just being organized, and I was able to get some, from my relationship with Boston, the people there I knew had sent me letters to some of the people here, so that I was able to get along fairly quickly here, and I was accepted into the medical community very quickly, and I had fairly good credentials, so there was no problem, and it worked out very well.
Good. Here's a question that I haven't asked anybody, and I guess I haven't thought about it. Were there many Jewish doctors in Seattle when you got here, and were they Seattle raised, or like you, did they come after World War II? Many of them. Can you
answer that? They came. Most of them that are here came after World War II. It was a small group, mm-hmm. and I think you're familiar with them. There was Dr. Friedman, Klein, Jacobs, Minko that I met when I first came here. But they I hesitate to give you numbers because I'm not sure. But I would say it was less than 20. The ones that came, most of us came afterwards. But that wasn't true just for Jewish doctors. That was true for all the doctors. That was true for the pediatricians. There were only, 18 or 20 pediatricians here when I came to town. And within a period of 2-3 years, there were more than double that number. And when I wrote to Portland and to Dr. Bilderbach, he did then and still does say Portland is overcrowded as far as pediatricians are concerned. I think they still have maybe 30 or 40 there, whereas the community here said, there's plenty of opportunity for pediatricians here, and the community just grew. And that was the attitude of the pediatricians here in this community. They welcomed others. It was a very friendly, warm, happy association. Very quickly, they accepted you and they helped you get started. Mm-hmm. So it's a very good community medically. When I refer to that, I'm referring essentially to all the pediatricians. I'm not thinking of just the Jewish doctors in the community.
Tell me, what were your first impressions of the Seattle Jewish community coming from Toronto and whatever other Pittsburgh? How did Seattle's Jewish community stack up? What did you think?
Well, our community was much more cohesive. We all, as children, all of us went down to the Zionist Institute. And we had our Young Judea clubs and organizations of that sort. And whereas I think I had, from the medical school, I had, I would say approximately a third to a half of my friends were non-Jews, but my close associations on the weekend and things of that sort were Jews. When I came here, the community is spread so that it didn't have that cohesiveness. I, of course, heard about the dichotomy of the Sephardics and the Ashkenazi, which was sort of a big joke, as we were still joking in Toronto about the difference between the Polish Jews and the German Jews and the Galicianer and the rest of them, but it was more of a joke than a reality, and here it was a reality. Fortunately, it no longer is, and that is one of the things that I give credit to the Jewish Community Center as much as any other institution in this community, is to have brought all of us together. Passage of time, circumstances, of course, are all major factors, but the vehicle really was the Jewish Community Center.
Did you sense that there was also some residual separation between the old wealthy German Jewish families and the later immigrants?
I wasn't aware of it because I didn't know who they were. I met them, but it wasn't until long afterwards that I realized they are the old German Jewish families. As a physician, I saw many of them, and as far as I were concerned, they were Jews. I didn't know them well enough to differentiate them. I still am learning about whose brother and sister and uncles and aunts and cousins get together, and I know these individuals individually, and then I discover that they are related and that they. Something that I, a newcomer, and I classify myself as a newcomer as far as the ones who were native here and were born here.
Did you look for a congregation to join when you came?
Yes, when we first came here, it was the first thing we did, was found out where the Federation was, that we could send in a contribution. So we, that time we borrowed money, and I remember in 47, you know, that was a very critical time, so that I felt as though I had to make my contribution, and even though the money had been borrowed from others in order to get me started, I felt as though I was going to be, I still had more than what any they did over there. And I can remember having to get in touch with what organization do you have to, can you send it to? And one of the doctors said, well, how can you afford to give $100? Well, $100 I already knew wasn't very much for that, but the level of giving here was relatively low at the time. That was one part,
Did you find a place to give?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. Hochberg, who's the, and there was a, Federation was well organized. Not well, it was organized. What was his name? The, Hockenberg. He has his son here now. And he was there, and if I'm not mistaken, he was just still part-time. I'm not too sure about that. Or maybe he was full-time and his secretary was part-time. It was a very small organization. As far as organizations, the temples were already well organized. Now, they've been going for a long time, and we joined Herzl because we felt that conservative temple, and I forget who the rabbi was, but we were very satisfied until they kept changing rabbis, and we felt, well, this was rather unstable, and we felt...
Was it Rabbi Penner who was the first?
Rabbi Penner was the one when we left, Rabbi Penner. No, it was somebody else.
Okay, he was preceded by Franklin Cohn, I believe.
I don't recall who that was. I don't recall his name, so who would that be? No, I can't be sure. I don't know the dates. In any case, we changed then to Temple de Hirsch. And I don't know how long I was there, but I was on the education committee and one thing and another. But the impression I had as a newcomer was that I wasn't part of a clique. And therefore, I was accepted, but I wasn't part of it.
As far as power structure?
And also as far as being able to make contributions in whatever way I thought I could make a contribution. The other part was that it was a very large temple, and I didn't ever feel I could become intimate with that large a group, nor could my children. So that it wasn't very long afterwards that we decided we had to do something about it as far as those of us who had similar inclinations, and I don't know what year it was, but we started organizing Temple Beth Om, and there were half a dozen of us who met here in this house, and then we had various meetings, and then we had a big meeting at Hillel, and before very long we had a temple that we were supposed to be contributing and participating. Participating was the main word. You had to participate. We had no rabbi. We had our services in the on 47th and 16th, which was the church that the Unitarian Church had at that time, and it was a lovely little church there. Have you been by it at all?
No.
You must go by it. It's a lovely little church. I don't know what's being used for, and very rustic looking. We rented facilities from them, and then when they moved, they said, would you continue renting when we moved? And they needed our income, and we needed them, so it was a very good relationship. And by that time, we could afford a rabbi. But the first rabbi we had was sent to us by the good Lord, and Rabbi, can't remember his name, was taking a master's degree at the university here in theology and working for the government down in Tacoma, so that he used to come up here all the time, the government was paying his salary so we could afford him, that worked out very well.
Yes. Let me back up a little bit on that. Before you ever founded Temple Beth Om, did you have meetings for religious purposes, independent of other congregations?
Yes. As I say, for a while we would have our Friday night services in the various homes. And we did that for quite a long time.
With how many people involved?
Oh, anywhere from a dozen to 25. Not 25, no, a dozen to maybe 18, 12 to 18. We'd usually have a minion, but not many more, because we were all pretty faithful about coming. So it didn't vary that much.
Did you have a Torah?
No, we didn't get a Torah until we were in the at the Unitarian Church, and my father came out at the time. And first Torah we had was borrowed from Temple de Hirsch, and they provided us with the old books that they had bought new ones, and the Torah, which was a big help to us. And when my father came out, at the time my mother was alive, he said he wanted to donate a Torah to us, so that he did. So that was our first Torah that the organization owned. And since then we've acquired a third Torah, which was from Czechoslovakia. And I don't know whether you're aware of that story. There were Torahs that were picked up during the Holocaust from the various synagogues and hidden. And they were all brought to London and restored. And you could purchase one from London. And the one that we had came from one of the synagogues in Czechoslovakia, and it was purchased in London. And Al Schreiber can tell you the story about how he delivered it to us. And it had to be carried. You can't ship them for some reason or other. I can't recall all the details.
Huh. Did you get other encouragement from Temple de Hirsch?
Essentially, that was the main thing. I think Rabbi Levine came out a few times. Rabbi Phillips, who was then had a pulpit, but came out from in Chicago, and came out here, and he participated in some of our services. And those were sort of visiting situations.
Was there any resentment on part of people in Temple de Hirsch that felt that this was
we weren't strong
renegade
enough for anybody to resent, as far as I could. If there was, we didn't feel it especially, simply because we were too small. We weren't a threat to anybody.
Okay. Now, I do know that Al said it on the 25th anniversary that there were really three major groups of people that made up Beth Hall to begin with. Herzl people were one-third, Temple de Hirsch approximately, Temple de Hirsch people, and unaffiliated. Why did Beth Om go reform?
I don't differentiate the source of the people, because we were all pretty much alike, and if we were too far off, they had to leave. And there were a few that were a little more traditional than what we seemed to develop into. But there was a big choice. Should we join with the conservative group, or should we join with the Union of Hebrew College Temples? But the final choice came because the union actually sent us some money, or promised us some money, and promised us some help, whereas the conservative organization didn't. So that was the I think that was the reason we essentially yes.
Okay. What do you think? I don't want to go into all the accomplishments of Beth Om, but what do you think distinguishes Beth Om from the other congregations in the city? Particularly the other reform, but all.
In the early days, it was our people belonged to Temple Beth Om truly participated in all the services. We still don't have a men's club and a women's club. The women and the men all participate equally. That may or may not add to the strength, but be that as may, that was the attitude that we had, and you had to participate. And if you didn't participate, then we were almost at the point where you couldn't be a member. We talked about it. I don't think we ever said somebody couldn't join, but the pressure was on to become part of it. By participation, it was not only in it was participate in the services. We conducted our own services, and you had to take your turn. The financial end of it, and all the other aspects of it, were all of us had to be very active in it. We were small and we needed that sort of support. Going on in years, things have changed, but we still now, I think, are very much more interested in the social community and the social action committees, I think, have been very important in within our group. The Sunday school